There was an idea.
To bring together a group of remarkable people.
To see if we could become something more.
So when they needed us, we could make the podcasts.
That they never could.
In time, you will know what it is like to cross over. To feel so desperately that the comic is right, yet to fail all the same. Dread it. Run from it. March 2021 still arrives.
Evacuate the network. Engage all defenses. And get this man a cold Mountain Dew.
Ooh, a cold Mountain Dew. I haven't tried one of those. Nah. Make it warm. Thank you.
Fun isn't something one considers when podcasting an event. But this does put a smile on my face.
Who the hell are you guys?
The Merry Marvel Marching Society. We don't know where we're going, but we're on the way.
A podcasting crossover mega event in the spirit of JL May. Coming in March 2021. Covering Marvel's fall crossover event, Axe of Vengeance.
A cabal of evil threatens the Avengers and the entire Marvel Universe.
Dr. Doom, the Red Skull, Kingpin, Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Wizard, Dr. Doom, the Mandarin, and Dr. Doom have banded together to pit Earth's mightiest heroes against foes they have never faced before.
An array of heroes face enemies they are totally unfamiliar with.
But who is secretly pulling the vengeful cabal strings?
And can the Avengers take down the true mastermind before his hidden scheme succeeds?
Featuring podcasts from Third Degree Burn, Back to the Bins, Avenger Spotlight, Coffee and Comics, Comic Book Time Machine, Doom Speak, Fan Holes Podcast, Fire and Water Podcast Network, Head Speaks, Into the Weird, Justice, Not Entirely Dissimilar to Lightning, a Thunderbolts podcast, Longbox Crusade, Married with Comics, The Quantum Cast, Resurrections, an Adam Warlock podcast, Rolled Spine Podcasts, and Views from the Longbox.
Marching its way to your favorite podcatchers and hosting sites in 2021.
Act of Vengeance, a true story.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of FW Presents, the random catch-all anthology show of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly, and this extra special episode is part of the 2021 Merry Marvel Marching Society podcast crossover event. Throughout the month of March, something like 17 or 18 different podcasters or groups are going to be covering issues of the 1989 Marvel crossover Acts of Vengeance. Towards the end of the show, I'll mention the names of the other podcasts where you can follow along with this crossover. They'll also be listed in the show notes for this episode if you need it. For our part, my guest and I are going to be covering two issues of The Avengers. I know, it's such an obscure title. Specifically, we're going to discuss issues 312 and 313. But before we get into Acts of Vengeance, I need to introduce you to my very special guest. He is so special because this is his first time on a podcast, but I have known him since I was a senior in high school, and we've kept in touch the last couple of years over social media. And when this opportunity came up to do something kind of fun and atypical for this podcast, I immediately thought of roping him in to help me cover these comics. Listeners, please welcome a fan of superheroes and all Chicago sports, my pal, Jake M. How's it going, man?
Going great, Ryan. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. It's a real thrill to be part of this network and these podcasts. You and I go back a little ways, so it's extremely cool that that you do what you do. But I can say honestly, Fire and Water podcasts are the only comics pods I listen to. So this is a real pleasure for me, and I appreciate you having me on.
We got the exclusive. I love it. I love hearing stuff like that. I have to ask about your comic book origin story, and this isn't just for the listeners' benefit, but also for my own, because I didn't know you were into this stuff until a couple of years ago when we started talking on Twitter. We met my senior year, which was also probably the time when I was the least into comics. So I don't think it never would have come up back when we were rehearsing for Grease or whatever it was. But then I think it was right around before Avengers Infinity War came out. Vanity Fair had these series of covers featuring all of their Marvel heroes from all of the different movies, and they were all kind of mixed and matched into different groups of like 4 and 5. And I posted one that I liked on Twitter, and you said something like, that's like the West Coast Avengers lineup. And I fell back because I was like, you know who the West Coast Avengers were? How come we've never talked about this? That's a deeper cut. So how and when did you start reading comics, and which books in particular were your favorites or your regular reads?
Well, to be honest, as much as I love comics, there are times I feel like a bit of a poser, only because I got started with comics as IPs, as intellectual properties, instead of as comic books themselves, which, you know, is the type of thing that I'm sure Marvel and Disney love to hear these days. But I started watching comics on TV and in films before I ever started reading them. When I was real little, I used to watch the Adam West Batman series in reruns on WFLD 32 here in the Chicago area. So that's where I learned most of what I knew about Batman. I saw, you know, Christopher Reeve in Superman 1 and 2. And that's where I learned the Superman mythos. And then there was a video store back in our hometown, Stars and Stripes Video, and they had a whole line of tapes with a combination of the Merry Marvel Marching Society show from the 60s, and then some of the cartoons that they made in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So I ran through every copy of those that they had and got really hooked that way. And then I was really lucky because when I turned about 9, Batman and the X-Men had animated series on Fox. And so I added that to my, you know, my Saturday morning or my after school lineup of things that I watched. And, you know, I was really, really clued into all that. And so actual comic reading was mainly limited to my grandmother bringing me a comic every once in a while when she went to a garage sale or a flea market, until, as it happens, Avengers number 305, written by John Byrne and with art by Paul Ryan, the exact creative team that we're going to be talking about today.
Wow.
That was where I started with the Avengers. That was where I started as a semi-regular comic reader. Their run, as I found out doing some research, started with that issue, and that was what got me going as well.
Folks, those of you listening, I had no idea about this. Like, we certainly never did. I had no idea that you were that familiar, that you just started right around the time of like a few months before the books that we're going to be talking about. That is perfect.
It hit me like a bolt of lightning when you said you want to talk about Avengers 312 and 313. I thought, well, yeah, I guess so. That's about where it goes back to for me. So I didn't read super regularly because I was reliant on, you know, my folks to buy me comics. I was only like 6 then. So by the time I got to high school, I started going to Graham Cracker Comics here in DeKalb, Illinois, where I still live and where you and I grew up and went to high school together. Kept collecting comics a little bit through college. And then even though I was initially very resistant, I have now fully embraced the digital comics age, and it's wonderful being able to go back and read through all the stuff that I missed through all the years, and also catch up on stuff that, you know, I'd read only years ago. And that was exactly how I caught up on these issues for talking today. Through a digital collection of Acts of Vengeance.
Very cool. Yeah, I also read them on the Marvel Digital Unlimited app to get familiar with those. That's cool. I had no idea. And you were into the Avengers long before I was, because, you know, I made no secret. Like I was a diehard mutant fan when I got started, because it sort of all happened at the same time. I got into collecting regular monthly comics right in 1990, and then which fell in line very quickly was the X-Men animated series on Fox, and then the toy line by Toy Biz that kind of coincided. All of those things kind of that trifecta hit me. So I was big reading X-Men right around the time that Jim Lee and Chris Claremont were leaving their run, and I was picking up. But I knew of the Avengers just whenever they would guest star or whenever there were crossovers. I didn't meet a lot of those characters until, I don't know if you ever remember, I think it was in like the lobby or the mezzanine of Walmart. There was the Captain America and the Avengers arcade game.
Do I remember? Right. Oh my gosh. I wasted so much of my parents' hard-earned money on trying to get anywhere in that game.
Yeah, and I keep coming back. I tell people, like, I knew who Captain America was, but I think that was the first time I heard of Iron Man, Hawkeye, and Vision was playing that game.
You know what? You could do a lot worse.
Yeah. But the first time I actually bought an Avengers comic wasn't until after the Heroes Return thing. It was during the Kurt Busiek and George Perez run. And then I started getting into more later. So we're talking now late 90s and then early 2000s. And then by the end of that run, I started following the Avengers when Brian Bendis took over and redubbed it as New Avengers. And then at that same time, I was able to go back through the old Marvel Essential volumes, the black and white reprints that looked like phone books. That's when I went back to go back and read through their history. And then again, through the digital, I've been able to go back and read their catalog. And now, you know, maybe it was just a phase, but it's much harder for me to connect to and relate with the X-Men and the mutant characters. And I find myself a much bigger fan of the Avengers and that world of characters and their satellites. All right. Well, then before we get into the comics, then I do have to ask, who are some of your favorite Avengers members? Like if you had to list like a, you know, top three, top five.
I have a top five because it was honestly hard to limit myself even that much. But for me, it begins and ends with Captain America, especially in this run that we're talking about. I think the notion of Cap as the quintessential leader, completely unflappable, cool under pressure, no matter the situation, and the way that he commands respect. I've always loved the dynamic that despite being technically the least powerful guy in the room, anytime he's the leader of the Avengers, they all fall in line. Because his will is indomitable, his ability to bring people together to strategize before going into battle is second to none. And there's even a moment in one of the issues that we're talking about today where even the Mandarin stops to pay homage to Cap. Instead of finishing him off, he says, out of respect, I'm going to take a moment. And to me, that's Captain America in a nutshell right there. The fact that everyone respects him and falls in line. And so he's always going to be my favorite Avenger, top of the list.
Yeah.
I love Hawkeye because Hawkeye is the anti-Cap. Always in Cap's shadow, fights back against him hard because obviously, secretly, he wants to be him. And over time has, you know, chaired and created so many groups just to try and prove himself just as good at leading a crew as Cap. Great Lakes Avengers, Thunderbolts, whomever he had to try and fall in line behind him. You know, it's all just an inferiority complex trying to be Captain America. But I love Hawkeye because he's so irreverent. He's so not straight-laced. He's the opposite of the stuffy, overly noble, and full of themselves heroic figure. He's the everyman. He's quick with a wisecrack, and I've always found that to be especially endearing. And then after that, Thor. Thor's the lovable lug He's the idiot who charges into battle headlong and loves a fight more than anything else. But you know, he's adorable. He's like the dog that you just can't help but love. And he's also kind of the unofficial gatekeeper of the Avengers. You know, I love that if you're gonna make it in the group, you got to kind of prove yourself. And if Thor likes you, then you're doing okay.
Yeah.
I love the Black Panther, even though he's such a standout character on his own, and his stories, you know, especially as has been, you know, brought out more in the last few years, his entire mythos is fascinating, and he has his own world. He has his own ethic. I really like T'Challa in the group dynamic. And he just happened to show up again in around the time that I started reading the book. And I love that, you know, he's kind of take care of business and don't make a big stink about it, you know, which is great in a team dynamic in that he'll do the dirty work and he'll get to it. And it's not about ego. It's not about, you know, proving that he's more powerful or going off half cocked for T'Challa. It's all about, you know, what am I going to do to save the world today? And it'll be whatever it has to be. So I've always liked that about him. And then in terms of having a strong female presence, I've always loved the Wasp as a member of the Avengers. And, you know, it tickled me no end when I learned after I started reading that she had been a chair of the Avengers for as long as she had, because first reading her, I thought, well, she's flighty. She's a fashion designer. You know, she won't get off of Henry Pym's arm. You know, everything is defined by that. She's the girl of the group, but it turns out, you know, she has so much determination, sheer force of will and tenure. And it means something in the Avengers to have been doing it for a long time. And Wasp constantly over and over again proves her worth as a part of that group. And I love that. And I missed a little bit that, you know, when the MCU started, she didn't get to be part of the core group. I got that decision from, you know, a complicated filmic perspective, but I was really glad she found her way into the movies eventually, because I felt like she got paid kind of short shrift in not being part of that original group, because I really love having the Wasp around.
You're like reading my mind. You're reading my notes or something like this. This is, you know, freakish how much we overlap here. I 4 out of your 5 would also be in my top 5 too. Like, no kidding. Like that, like when you said, like, I would have Cap as number 1 and I would have Hawkeye as number 2. And then I would have the Wasp as my 3rd, like, favorite, or like what I think is like a crucial member of the Avengers in their history. And up to the same thing. I was like, I watched those movies now and I was like, all right. The dynamic that Steve and Black Widow have in the Avengers movies and in Civil War with Scarlet playing Black Widow, I was like, if she could have been Janet in those things and they could have had that kind of friendly camaraderie rapport of sort of co-leadership, if she could have been the Wasp in those movies instead of Black Widow, I'm just going to ache for something like that. Because you're right, I wish the Wasp had been there from the beginning if they had found a way of doing that.
And it really fits too with the characterization of Widow in the movies. She's not afraid to say anything. You know, she's always off the cuff. You know, I think Wasp really embodies that very well in the books. So I think the spirit was definitely there.
And when you read, if you go back and if you were able to read the Avengers continuity over decades, you see how she started as a very flighty, kind of ditzy. I mean, Stan Lee's idea of a woman on this team of like girls and everything. She's just like sizing up Thor for the eye candy, and she just wants, you know, Hank to take her out and meet her. But she is adventurous. She's naturally just like, she likes the fun of being a superhero. And you see her kind of grow and develop. And it's subtle because she was never really the star or the lead of many storylines. But you do see the change over time of her growth and her maturity into being a serious, competent presence on the team and a leader who can take it. So yeah, I love the Wasp too. Also love Black Panther. There was a time for a while when he was my favorite Marvel character. And I think maybe he might have just slipped down a little bit in my estimation just because of the exposure. Like once his movie started coming out, once everybody liked him, I was like, he's not as cool anymore for me. So and then so the one that I would swap my number 5 as an Avenger would be Monica Rambeau as Captain Marvel. I've liked her the more, and that's a relatively new addition just over the last couple of years. Hank Pym is one of my all-time favorite Marvel characters, but he's just, his history with the Avengers in particular is complicated, and I don't always think he was the best represented on the team. So when I think of my 5 favorite Avengers as they work with the team. Yeah, I think of Cap, Hawkeye, Monica, Janet, and T'Challa. So very, very cool. Cool. Alrighty, so let's get into the comics. Acts of Vengeance was a loose crossover told over several months in late 1989, early 1990, I think. In all, the event touched more than 70 comics. The premise for this crossover is that a cabal of the world's deadliest villains, the real arch-nemeses of the heroes, including Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Red Skull, the Mandarin, the Wizard, and the Kingpin, get together with the guidance of a mysterious other party who seems to be up to his own schemes. The villains take a different approach to crushing their enemies. After watching the movie Strangers on a Train, they swap enemies, you know, crisscross. Or it might have been Throw Mama from a Train, one of those movies. In about 70 comics, you get superheroes fighting villains that they have never fought before. That was the gimmick. I mean, you start reading just before this, like, I assume then you were familiar with this crossover because this would have been right around that time.
Yeah, I saw it, you know, at the top of covers around that time, and I was like, oh, I got to pay attention to this. I got to pick this up. And, you know, it was an exercise in early futility and a crash course in how comics get sold. Every story, you know, ended on another cliffhanger. And you just had to buy the next book or else you weren't going to find out what was actually ultimately going to happen. It was very frustrating, but also extremely compelling. And the idea of, you know, part of why I like the Avengers is so many characters in one place. And for someone new to the medium, you know, it was just a smorgasbord, you know, and give me more. I want to learn more about, you know, these different people with these different power sets. And so you get that with the Avengers baked in. And then in Acts of Vengeance, all of a sudden, you've got all these different villains coming in from every corner of this wide ranging universe. I mean, it was very fan servicey, to borrow a term from the movies and TV. But I mean, especially at my age, first reading it when I was like six, it was irresistible.
All right, let's start off with Avengers 312. The title is "Has the Whole World Gone Mad?" It was written by John Byrne, penciled by Paul Ryan, inked by Tom Palmer, lettered by Bill Oakley, colored by Christy Shealy, edited by Howard Mackey. The cover date is December 1989, but the actual on-sale date was October 17th, 1989. Five Avengers, Hank Pym, the Wasp, Vision, the Scarlet Witch, and the Falcon, gather in a basement headquarters beneath Avengers Park, watching TV monitors showing other heroes being attacked all over New York and elsewhere. Hank, the smartest Avenger, is at a loss to explain the various crises playing out. He is much more concerned with Wanda's present state of mind after the numerous traumatic events have played out in her life. Boy, is that an evergreen situation right now. Elsewhere, the mysterious three-piece suit-wearing mastermind behind the Acts of Vengeance crossover, whose identity we totally don't know, wink,
nope.
Meets with the cabal, sometimes referred to as the Prime Movers, which again includes Dr. Doom, Magneto, Kingpin, the Wizard, the Mandarin, and the Red Skull. Interestingly enough, not all of them, especially Magneto, a Holocaust survivor, are thrilled at sharing a table with a living Nazi like the Red Skull, which makes this group of supervillains morally superior to half of the United States Congress. Three members of Freedom Force, the Blob, Avalanche, and Pyro, who used to be part of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, show up at Avengers Park looking for the Avengers. Vision confronts them, and they start to fight. The other Avengers join in, and everybody fights. Vision struggles against the Blob, even with his mass manipulation, until Pym shrinks the Blob down to bug size, and he crashes through the ground into a subway tunnel. The Wasp blasts one of Pyro's tubes, and Hank clogs the other. Avalanche uses vibration waves to damage Vision and destroy Falcon's wings. When Vision is hurt, Wanda gets pissed. Pyro orders the cops to attack the Avengers, since Freedom Force is a government task force. Captain America arrives and says, not so much. This isn't a sanctioned operation. Civilians in the street start to riot over the question of whether the Avengers are good or bad. Avalanche takes advantage and causes an earthquake. He and Pyro escape, abandoning the Blob. Vision recovers and Wanda hugs him, while Cap and the others stand around angry that the villains kind of won again. So, Jake, what did you think of this first issue?
Well, I liked it. especially because it exemplifies a lot of what I fell in love with the Avengers in the first place, in the sense that there's just enough time taken for characterization and individual character beats with the various members. But ultimately, they got to get down to business pretty quickly, and they got to spend a fair amount of page space dispatching with threat. And, you know, in terms of just kind of going after the id and getting that, you know, raw enjoyment out of a comic, it gets to the fight pretty fast. The fight takes up a pretty big portion of it. And then what is rich about it is the way that the, in this case, the two teams, or the three teams really, interact with one another. The Avengers as a unit trying to adjust to this threat that they've never adequately faced before. They don't know Freedom Force. They don't, you know, they have some familiarity with their power set and the fact that they thought that they were a government-sponsored faction, but they don't really know how to dispatch them properly. They mentioned, well, these are the X-Men's foes, and if the X-Men were alive right now, we could talk to them about how to beat them. That's right. There was a time when the X-Men wanted everybody to think they were dead. And on the other side of it, Freedom Force is just kind of reveling in the fact that, you know, they've got a chance to take a shot at the Avengers. This is sort of a grab at glory for them. They've just lost their leader in Mystique, so they're sort of rudderless. And, you know, this is their chance to kind of take a step up in the world. And they've been given this strange anonymous tip that they can find the Avengers in Avengers Park. So what do? They start tearing up the park and pick a fight. But ultimately, they're not that much better organized than the Avengers are. They have their own squabbles because they're all about ego, and they panic very easily when confronted with this power set that they also are not that familiar with. And then in the background, you've got the Cabal, the Prime Movers, who are at each other's throats just as much as the two warring teams. And the dynamics of that are, as you alluded to, fascinating, because you've got these disparate personalities. Every one of them thinks that not only are they the superior criminal mind, they think they have a moral high ground. And it's ridiculous and sublime all at once to have Magneto and the Wizard, who himself is Jewish, going after the Red Skull for being a Nazi when they themselves are mass murderers. And there's evil, but then there's an ultimate evil that they themselves won't stand for. And it's delightful. It's delightful watching them squabble, even though at times, to really underscore just how terrible they are, some of the racist comments made by the villains in this issue are pretty deep, dark cuts. At one point, the Red Skull says to Magneto, "There was a time when your kind would have been boiled down into soap." And I thought, that is very specific. And I did not remember that as a six-year-old. That probably didn't register with me at the time. But just the fact that they can't stop squabbling and that there's almost as much violence going on in their secret back room as there is out in Avengers Park. I mean, it's great. There's so many layers to it, and it's just conflict everywhere. But examining the different team dynamics is just really, really fun.
I like the not at all subtle reminder that there are supervillain mass murderers, as you described them, and then there's a literal Nazi, and whoa, we got to draw the line somewhere. And there's even among the villains, they're like, I'm not sitting next to that guy.
Seriously.
And I do like the fact, like, I mean, in a room with these characters, Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Kingpin, like all these things, like, it would be very, very easy for the Wizard, really, the guy like best known as like the leader of the Frightful Four, to just disappear into the background. But I like the fact that he's the first to speak up and really take his shot against the Red Skull. I like that.
Because to be a supervillain, you have to believe that you are the most powerful, the most dangerous person on the planet. And so the Wingless Wizard, he buys into his own lie. You know, he knows deep down that he's completely out of his depth in this grouping, but you're never going to get him to admit that.
Right. I like the fact that two of these guys think they're the intellectual superior of Reed Richards. One of them maybe can back it up, but
maybe. But it's a stretch. It's
A stretch. I was conflicted, like when I was reading this one, because on the one hand, I thought that this showed a little bit of Marvel's own internal bias towards the mutants, or favoritism towards the mutants during this time period, because I was like, three members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants going against five Avengers? I'm like, this shouldn't even be a contest. Like, the Avengers should wipe the floor with these guys. No way. And then I kind of looked, I was like, all right, I love the Avengers in this lineup. I like these guys. You know, I love Falcon. I love Wasp and Hank Pym, and Vision and Wanda are supremely powerful. I was like, but this does feel like kind of a team of B-listers for me. Like, and I think it's just because until he shows up at the end, this is a team that feels like it's lacking a heavy, because for me, I don't need to have the big three of Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor on the team all the time. But I feel like if you don't have one of them, you're lacking something with the Avengers. My own little bias. So I was like, okay, these guys might not be, you know, they should be able to take the Brotherhood, but maybe they'll go a couple rounds or something. It'll be a little bit more of a scrap.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely on point there. It definitely does feel like this is sort of second tier. But I also think that this issue is kind of justifying the entire premise of the crossover in some sense, because there's a lot of factors that keep Freedom Force in the fight. Like you talked about, the Avengers are without a clear leader. They're also without, you know, their alphas, the people who would lead them in a fight normally. As I talked about, the factor of, you know, they even have a discussion really quickly. Falcon tries to get intel on what they're up against from Hank Pym. And, you know, the best Hank can do is be like, well, the X-Men fight them and they've got, you know, one of them's got fire powers, I think. And that's the best that they can do. But there's also, you know, there's things distracting this Avengers team, especially Wanda and Vision and Hank Pym to some extent worrying about their situation. And it's only because of all of those disparate things getting in the way that Freedom Force is even able to stand a chance.
Yeah, that's a good point. In terms of just like kind of looking at the roster of these characters, like I mentioned, like the first time I saw the Vision was in that that arcade game, which is this version of the Vision, is the white one. It was after John Byrne destroyed him and rebuilt him and kind of like stripped away his history with Wanda and the personality and left him more as a kind of cold, robotic, you know, mechanical synthesoid, which now that we've seen WandaVision and everything, and that is the version that might be in the MCU's future, he might be more popular than ever. But I always kind of felt like this Vision was, you know, he didn't do anything for me when I saw him. And then when I saw the older version was, you know, red and green and yellow, I was like, that one looks much more interesting. And oh, he can cry and he has this relationship. He gets married. I was like, this is a lot more interesting. What did Byrne do to this character? So I've always kind of felt like this version of Vision, not really my favorite. Yeah.
Well, and it's so interesting that, you know, your feelings are mirrored by something that Scarlet Witch is going through in the early pages of the issue, right? She's looking at the all white, stark, completely robotic and emotionless Vision, and she is seeing him as the original.
Paul Ryan actually gives us that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's on purpose. You know, I think Byrne wants us to try and adjust to this version of Vision, but, you know, I think acknowledges that there's a sense of loss that that original version isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm.
I like Hank Pym. He's one of my favorite characters, but at this point, I mean, he'd been through such the emotional ringer that in the West Coast Avengers, they stripped him down. They made him their tech guy, Professor Pym, which is probably the most grounded, the most rational, the most consistent the character has ever been. But to me, I was like, he didn't get a costume. He was just in like a red jumpsuit, like he was their auto mechanic. And then once John Byrne came aboard, he sort of elevated him and made him kind of the de facto leader of that time. But he, in order to do that, he was really pushing Hawkeye out the door. And I felt like that was kind of unfair. He also kind of supplanted Janet and kind of getting them back together, I felt like reduced her role and her growth over time too. So I don't know. I've got a complicated history and feelings about John Byrne. I find him fairly hit or miss with his titles. So I think he made some dynamic and some interesting changes to the group and the core at the time when they needed to kind of be spiced up a little bit, but not all of those changes were for the better.
Yeah, I think you're right. He definitely broke eggs to make omelets. And, and, you know, like you said, some things were hit and some things were miss. And, you know, reading Hank Pym for the first time like this, without knowing his history as Goliath and as Yellow Jacket, you know, you wonder, what is this guy even doing here? Because you're right. There's nothing visually, certainly, to distinguish him as a superhero, as being the equal of the rest of these, you know, almost mythic figures that he's around. And he's pulling stuff out of his pockets and then, you know, raising it in size so that he can use like gas pellets and guns. It's like, this is a really boring version of Batman's utility belt. this guy doesn't look like a hero. He doesn't sound like a hero. And yeah, it was a little bit disconcerting to see him push those far more lively and just interesting to read characters out of the way for the purpose of having some measure of leadership. He does stick out like a sore thumb at times, especially, I will note, on the cover of this book, where his jumpsuit has gone from red to purple, as often happens in these days. And for whatever reason, his gun is full size and he looks like Sergeant Rock. He looks like a character out of a Kubert War comic from the 60s. And I'm like, well, that's the butchest that Hank Pym ever looked right there.
Yeah, really. Speaking of that, though, what did you think about Paul Ryan's art, you know, overall?
I love Paul Ryan's art. You know, it was the first thing that I saw in comic books that made me think that it was more of an elevated art form above like what I read Sundays in the newspaper. He's got that photorealistic style, and obviously he's got, you know, clear reference points that he works off of. And I even read interviews where he talked about that. And you can tell with the facial details, the use of shadow, upon, you know, all the different facial features, and really does a great job, to me at least, distinguishing these characters from one another. It's one of the easiest things to do in comic books, I think, to make everybody look the same. They might be dynamic, you know, they might look heroic, but, you know, kind of one guy looks the same as the next guy. And with Paul Ryan's art, you know, there's so much detailing in the contours of the face, you know, their dimples, the line of the neck, the chin, the eyes. His eyes are so incredibly detailed. And it really sticks out with some of the villains who have helmets on their face, like Doom and Magneto, where you can see through the use of shadow, there's space between where the helmet ends and where their face begins again. And it gives them a depth that I think is really difficult to establish with comic art. There's not, you know, a white slit where somebody's eye should be anywhere. You know, he really uses every part of the face. And even down to there's a cleft in Cap's chin, the way that he draws Captain America, that... Yep. To me is iconic. I really gravitate towards that version of Captain America when I think of sort of the platonic ideal of that. So the one thing I would take issue with, easy for me to say because I can barely draw a stick figure, but his backgrounds, his layouts are strikingly stark. There's so many scenes where there's incredibly detailed action going on in the foreground, but the background is just blank white. There's not a building. There's not even sky. It's like they're in a void. And so at times that kind of takes me out of it, out of the action on the page, if I think about it too much. But, you know, I think it's because he's doing so much. You know, Tom Palmer did his inks for this issue, but I've read, you know, that he liked to ink a lot of his own stuff because he's incredibly detailed on those figures and on telling stories through faces and movement that some things fall by the wayside.
Yeah. For me, for like getting into the comics of this era, I kind of felt like Paul Ryan's style was almost kind of close to the house style for the Avengers and the Fantastic Four. And I think it kind of goes back to the other area where I met a lot of these characters was in trading cards. They had like the Marvel Universe trading cards in the 90s. And in particular, the set from either 92 or 93 that had the cosmic starscape background. I collected all of those or a bunch of those at the time. And for me, like that was some of the first times when I had ever seen some of these characters were on those cards. And Paul Ryan drew a bunch of them. He drew a lot of the Avengers characters. He drew a lot of all the Fantastic Four characters, because then he would take over Fantastic Four when Tom DeFalco started writing that book too. But that sort of solidified him as like that's what those figures look like. That was kind of their default. The way on the DC end of things, you would think of like the definitive version of all of those DC heroes is from the style guide by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. Of the, you know, whenever you see, you know, on the merchandise, on the t-shirts and everything, it's all that same art style. Jose did that, you know, that style, you know, to perfection. I mean, with Marvel, I mean, if you're going back, you would say either the Kirby version or the Ditko version or a John Buscema version from the 70s. But for me, looking at them in the 90s, if I wasn't reading the X-Men books or something, my visual idea of so many of these Avengers characters was the way Paul Ryan drew them. So that's kind of like, it's almost like stock version for me from that era.
So are you saying that that Paul Ryan read how to draw superheroes the Marvel way? Maybe a couple of editions took that really to heart.
Yeah, very, very much.
You're absolutely right. And it doesn't bother me, you know, that he really did, you know, kind of embody Marvel House style, because, you know, I was just eating it up with a spoon. But reading other books at the time, even reading the rest of the X-Vengeance crossover and seeing some of the very distinct, you know, sort of spectrum of styles between the various artists within these books, I just gravitate towards this one, I guess. It makes me feel, for the Avengers, you know, they're fantastical stories, but they're also kind of grounded. You know, they live in a very real New York. You know, even in this issue, they're dealing with, you know, public opinion and social issues. And so for me, the photorealism, it doesn't bug me. I kind of like it.
Yeah. All right, moving on to the next story. Avengers 313 has, well, pretty much the same creative team, although the colors for this one are credited to Michael Rockowitz. The cover date for this issue was January 1990, but the on-sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, was November 21st, 1989. The story is called Thieves' Honor. The Avengers' ever-faithful butler, Jarvis, monitors the situation on the street near Avengers Park, where protesters have started demanding the removal of all superheroes from New York. Captain America, Wonder Man, and the Vision dive down into the water to investigate the remains of the sunken Hydro base. The Mandarin arrives at Avengers Park. When a cop gets in his face, the Mandarin fries him. He then lays waste to a bunch of cops in tactical gear. At the secret headquarters of the Prime Movers, Dr. Doom watches the Mandarin enraged. Red Skull insults Doom. Doom hits Skull. Skull takes out a gun and shoots Dr. Doom. And Kingpin comes in and tells them that they're both acting like jackasses. Elsewhere, Agatha Harkness checks on Wanda, who is virtually catatonic. Something distracts Agatha, but when she goes outside, her entire house lifts up into the air, flies away, leaving Wanda alone inside the floating house with Magneto in the scene that so many people thought would be in the finale to WandaVision. Cap, Simon, and Vision are investigating Hydro Base underwater when they get word from Jarvis and they race back to confront the Mandarin. Along the way, Simon and Vision bump into the Wizard and they fight. Captain America's Quinjet is shot down by the Mandarin, but before the Mandarin can finish him, he is attacked by Black Widow and Hellcat, who were responding to Jarvis's alert. The Mandarin holds his own against Cap, Widow, and Hellcat, but then Thor arrives and takes him out. Mandarin escapes, leaving the Wizard behind, so he gets captured by the Avengers. He tells them the entire Acts of Vengeance thing was his idea. The evil mastermind watches this and then sees the Prime Movers. Red Skull isn't happy with the Mandarin sacrificing the Wizard, and then Dr. Doom explodes, revealing it was a Doombot all along. And this story is continued in Avengers West Coast. So what did you think of this one?
It's so apt that you brought up that in 312, in the previous issue, we've got, you know, kind of second tier X-Men villains fighting what is definitely a B-team, a makeshift team of Avengers. And here in this issue, now we've got the Mandarin throwing in. And so the threat has been upped and the Avengers' response has also been upped, because now Cap throws his hat into the ring. He's fully involved in this fight. Wonder Man ups the power level, you know, significantly from where it was in the previous issue. And then by the end, even Thor has to get himself involved to really bring it home for the Avengers. So this definitely feels like, you know, we're getting to the end of the crossover. We need to ramp things up. And we do. It's a very clear escalation of where things were from the previous issue. And you can even see it on the cover where they call it, I think, the ultimate supervillain team up. That's a gross exaggeration because the wizard, but I like the idea. I like where their head's at. You know, okay, we're starting to come to the end of things here. So this is the one you want to watch. And it makes a big difference.
I feel like the Mandarin has always kind of been the de facto arch nemesis of Iron Man. Maybe just because he was there like early on and they just had like the longest rivalry, but I could never really point to a lot of standout Mandarin stories. So because of that, I tend to shortchange him and think of him as like a second rate arch nemesis. But really, when you think about it, with those 10 rings and the powers that he has at his disposal, the Mandarin should be a real, like, serious threat to deal with, should be an Avengers level threat, I believe.
Yeah, so it definitely plays out that way in this issue.
Yeah, it does. And he kind of had a weird place in the Axe of Vengeance because right around the same time, and he's wearing this new suit of feudal Chinese armor, has a vaguely samurai feeling, although that's the wrong ethnic group. The same time, a couple months earlier, he was in the X-Men issues where I think he's just wearing like a suit and he's involved in the resurrection of Psylocke in this new body. When she becomes part of like the hand, where she becomes, you know, the new sexy lady ninja chick because Elektra was killed off. But yeah, like seeing this, like, I was impressed. I was like, okay, this should actually be like a really cool threat. And then, I mean, once he's, you know, scrapping with Captain America and then like the you know, stealthy, agile ninja ladies and Black Widow and Hellcat take him out, I was like, I don't think you're in his league. And then when Thor shows up, the man was like, okay, maybe I need to get out of here.
That's, you know, Thor literally and figuratively brings the hammer down. And it's also literally Deus Ex Machina. He is the god in the machine.
He pretty much ends the fight just when he shows up. It is one of those things where it's like, oh, Thor is there. All right, we're throwing in the towel. Like,
I guess we had 3 pages left. We really needed to wrap this one up. So one Thor and we're out.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying. The number of classic Mandarin stories that I can come up with is nil. I just know he's Iron Man's guy. And Byrne actually, you know, takes great pains to establish that. Mandarin walks into the shattered Avengers Park. He picks up the statue head of Iron Man and says, God, if only he were here and I could kill him too. And then in a nice touch at the end, after Thor whomps him with one shot with Mjolnir, and he's slinking away in defeat, the shattered Iron Man statue head is there again in the frame, reminding him of his failure. So
yeah,
done this time, even not against Iron Man.
Yeah, that was good. For the MCU connection, we have seen a version of the Mandarin in Iron Man 3, which turned out to be a fake that pissed off a lot of people. I think it was a brilliant fake. I really like that reveal. But supposedly we are going to be getting much more of an authentic version of the Mandarin in the Shang-Chi movie that's supposed to be out later this year, hopefully, as a sort of cross between the Mandarin and Fu Manchu, since they can't actually call him Fu Manchu.
Right, the 10 rings.
Yep, that's the once they mention that as the title of the movie, it's like, all right, I guess we know. Which I'm not sure if I predicted this, but I sort of anticipated. I was like, wouldn't it be cool? Like, they can't call his dad Fu Manchu, but you need his dad. That's an important part of Shang-Chi's history. I was like, what if they just swapped and made his dad the Mandarin or something? And then, lo and behold, it looks like that's what they're doing. So,
really right, cool. You should write these things.
I should. Of course, the villains in the Cabal are going to fight each other because, of course, they do. And, of course, the Doctor Doom one is really a robot because, of course, it was like I try and mapping out which was the authentic Doom and which was the fake between the end of John Byrne's run on Fantastic Four and like the Heroes Return era. I have no idea if you could even do that.
I think it's probably a futile gesture.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I noted about both these issues is Byrne has got so many balls in the air that little details like that. I wonder if he even knew, you know, at what point Doom made the changeover, because it'd be impossible to track in everything that was going on.
When Cap crashes the Quinjet and he's lying like semi-conscious out of it, it really looks like Mandarin is going to karate chop him to death.
Boy, it sure does.
I was like, you've got those rings, except, I think Paul Ryan forgot to draw the rings on his hand in one of those panels.
Yeah, Paul has some trouble with hands. a couple points in these issues, Wanda's gloves disappear completely from her hands at one point. Yeah, it's why this is people's complaint about the MCU is that these incredible powers, these godlike beings, and so often it just comes down to a fist fight. So really going to finish off Captain America with a karate chop? That's what we got here?
Speaking of villains and their powers, you know, I love a good underdog story, and I like the Wizard as much as anybody, but he should not be getting the upper hand of either Wonder Man or the Vision, and certainly not both of them.
It's incredible. He just slips out of Wonder Man's grasp with no explanation as to why or how he would have been able to do that. He's got energy blasts that he just completely floors Simon Williams with that are apparently on par of something that, you know, Iron Man would shoot out of his repulsor rays. And he totally schools the Vision. Like, he taunts him for saying, well, you didn't think I was this quick, did you? And I'm reading it thinking, no, I didn't either, because I don't think you are. But okay, sure, I can swallow that, I guess.
I like the Avengers lineup that we get. You got a 6-person roster in this one: Captain America, Thor, Wonder Man, Vision, Hellcat, and Black Widow. On the one hand, I love it because it's a mix of different kinds of powers. It's a mix of different, you know, genders, some old, some new, some old, some young, things like that. On the other hand, it does feel very typical. Like, the guys are super powerful. Like, you've got Cap, who is his, kind of his own thing, the super soldier, who's always kind of achieves greater than maybe what he should be able to do just because he's Captain America. And then three really heavy class, you know, heroes in Thor, Wonder Man, and Vision. And then you've got the two ladies whose skills are fighting, agility, kicking, stuff like that, being, you know, being like the sexy spy girls. It's kind of like when you watch like the first Avengers movie, it's like, yeah, you got those big heroes and then Black Widow. It's like, yeah, okay, because we couldn't have She-Hulk on this team or somebody.
They're just kind of there, and yeah. I don't want to cast any aspersions on John Byrne and his treatment of women, but they do very much take a backseat in these two issues. And I wonder if Paul Ryan had trouble with Black Widow's face, just because she appears in about, you know, half the issue, and she's the only Avengers character who doesn't have a close-up at any point. She's in very, very, very much in the background and rendered in full body the entire time, which is strange and only underscores what you're saying, that they really are a minor factor to the whole thing, her and Hellcat. I'm glad they're there.
I love seeing them. And like, just like those are two characters who I don't know, like, well, have I ever seen them together before? And, you know, jumping across the skyline like Batman and Robin, they're cool. Yeah.
They did look like they belonged together, didn't they? And apparently, you know, at the very least, they must commute to battles together. You know, when Jarvis calls, they carpooled. But other than that, nothing really organic to put the two of those together. So kind of cool, but you're right. I wish they had been treated a little bit more equitably with the guys. Tough, though. Tough when you got heavy hitters like that.
Yeah. Overall, the entire Acts of Vengeance crossover, I feel like, because it was just confined to, like, there wasn't a main event series that was kind of guiding it. It was really just, here's the premise, and the books could just go with it however they wanted to approach it. So I think overall, it, whether or not the books were succeeded or not depended on how strong the creative team was. If there was a good writer and artist combo, if they approached it with some creativity. Byrne, because he was doing so many, he was handling the three Avengers books and the three West Coast Avengers books that were all kind of getting involved in it. I feel like these ones were more of an excuse of just, we're just going to have people fight. We're just going to, like, we just picked up, like, we just mixed and matched, and they're just fighting for some reason. And we're not really going to get more clever or industrious than that. It's just a fight for the sake of fighting, which is fine for the sheer entertainment value. I mean, these were fun, quick reads. I enjoyed them. They're not the greatest thing since sliced bread, but, you know, what is.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, as I talked about, they're a good shot of adrenaline for the reader, and especially for, you know, a voracious young reader who just likes the idea of seeing superheroes and villains duke it out. Kind of has a almost a Secret Wars feel to that. You know, like you said, just an excuse for a fight. But there's a reason you don't often hear this storyline talked about, you know, in the hallowed tones of some of the other bigger crossovers in Marvel history.
Right, right, right. All right, getting away from these comics, just a couple other kind of Avengers-centric questions. I asked you about favorite heroes. Favorite Avengers villains?
Well, it starts and ends with Loki. You know, I think in a very real sense, he was the first one. He brought them together. But there's also something that Loki represents to me about, you know, sort of the primacy and the importance of the Avengers in that, you know, once they get together, once they figure out whatever it is that he's planning and see through his tricks, the Avengers can usually dispatch with Loki without too much difficulty. But the point is, if they weren't all together, if they didn't pool their talents, they might not be able to. And so that's what I like about Loki, that he represents, you know, just enough of a threat that it takes all of them pooling their talents in order to put him down. And there's always that grudge factor. And that's what motivates this whole crossover, is that he's still sore about the fact that it's his fault that the Avengers got together in the first place and they pantsed him and he just can't let it go. And so I kind of like that as a motivation. You know, it's one thing that he's got the whole family issues with Thor, but, you know, Thor's buddies are the ones who really, really stick in his craw, because just the fact that they exist as a thing is enough to really get him hot and bothered. Ultron is always on my list because, you know, it's so visceral and personal, his rivalry with the Avengers. You know, if not for Hank Pym or Tony Stark in the MCU, he wouldn't exist. And it's kind of a nice poetic device that he exists to destroy his creator, to become more than the sum of his programming, and to evolve past those who made him. And that he knows them so well because he was programmed with, you know, the personality of an Avenger. Those were the engrams that made him. And so he really knows how to get to them at a very visceral level. I love when the Red Skull takes on the Avengers, because it's something different. He comes at things from a different perspective, and he's a manipulator, but he can also get his hands dirty. And like we talked about earlier, there is no higher evil than a Nazi. So that's, you know, it's always nice to see the Avengers kick that particular kind of ass. Kang stories are always fun and have a whole different layer to things, because, you know, how much more of a master manipulator can you be than to have time at your beck and call? A lot of complications, a lot of continuity and dizzying, you know, temporal mechanics to get through with Kang stories. But he really is one of the icons, and I hope that he gets his chance in the MCU at some point. And then I really like Taskmaster, because the thing that the Avengers have is the mix of abilities allows for a lot of these quote unquote street level heroes. You know, we talked about Cap, Hawkeye, Black Widow, Hellcat. You have to have those in the Avengers to complete the mix. And he's such a tremendous foil for those, because he can mimic any fighting style. But he also has the very irreverent personality that mirrors some of my favorite Avengers characters. So he's kind of like a dark mirror to some of the Avengers members that I like so much. So yeah, it's fun for me when he shows up.
Yeah, those are good. Those are good. Great list. Me too. I Ultron is my favorite. Has been, you know, since I got into the Avengers for all the reasons that you described. In terms of like another, maybe like a B-lister villain, I've always kind of liked the Grim Reaper and his connection to Wonder Man and Vision and that whole kind of dichotomy. The thing about him, though, is because his look is so simplistic, I find that it really, really depends on a good artist to pull it off. Otherwise, he just looks kind of boring and flat. But other than that, yeah. And just like the general, the all-purpose villains, like a MODOK and like AIM and Hydra and stuff like that. And Kang, too. Those guys. So, love them.
Those are great picks. Anybody who can send a horde of bad guys for the team to fight always makes for a good splash page and always gives all the various characters something to do. So, yeah, I like those two.
About a week ago, I reread the Kree Skrull War, all the issues involved in that, which... My memory was that the actual events out in space aboard ships fighting the two different alien species was a much bigger part of the storyline. And really, it's not. It's only the last two that really have like this intergalactic war. The first like two-thirds of that story arc are really crazy, involving all sorts of stuff with Ronan the Accuser and the like evolving apes and the Skrulls impersonating the Fantastic Four, and you've got Ant-Man crawling inside the Vision, and one of my favorite comics of all time because it's Neil Adams drawing Ant-Man. That's a crazy story, but I was like the last two chapters of this, when it's all in space and Mar-Vell and Rick Jones and everything are captured, if you could just expand that and make that part of it bigger, you know, if Roy and Neil and John Buscema, if they could have done more with that, then it would be great. But what are some of your favorite Avengers story arcs?
Well, the ones that are close to my heart, because they're what got me started, are pretty minor, barely even footnotes in Avengers history. This story, The Attack of the Lava Men, is the 3 or 4 issue arc that got me started. People don't know who the Lava Men are. It featured Gilgamesh and Circe as members of the Avengers team that didn't last as members for very long. But it taught me the Avengers team dynamic. It had She-Hulk as a member of the team. It had Quasar, if anybody remembers who Quasar is. It's quirky. It's out there, but I will always love that story. You mentioned earlier Busiek and Perez's run after Heroes Return. Some of the stories in those, I'm looking at the trade paperback right now, are just incredible. The stuff with Morgan Le Fay and Mordred, the resurrection of Wonder Man, having lived inside Wanda for so long, some of those stories, and how it became an event comic again. I really love
Ultron Unlimited from that run.
Yep, that's what I was going to say next.
That might be my number one all time. Yeah.
And you mentioned at the top, I got really into New Avengers and when Bendis brought back, you know, kind of that unique team, it was stunt casting to put Spider-Man and Wolverine on the Avengers. I knew it going in, but I was a sucker for it. So I love Breakout. I love the Sentry. That was, to me, it was something very, very different, and not like anything I'd read before. So I love those.
And I'm the same way. I mean, I got into that, and the stunt casting, you're right, with Wolverine and Spider-Man on the team, and I don't think of them as Avengers, but I think they did add some excitement to that team. But it also, I mean, within that lineup, I thought the breakout characters, the ones that I really got interested, were Spider-Woman and Luke Cage.
Yep.
I never really considered those characters before, but that made me want to go back and read their stuff from the 70s.
Yep, something I didn't know I needed in my life. But as soon as Luke Cage joined the Avengers, it kind of felt like hand in glove to me. And I thought that was quite the trick that that Bendis was able to pull off. And then lastly, the Ultimates. Technically not an Avengers story, and yet very much an Avengers story, incredibly influential into some of the things that have been done with the character since then. It was a fresh take. It was a harder take on the Avengers than I kind of preferred, but the fact that it looked at what was at the core of the team and what made those characters what they were, and then reinterpreted it, I found really captivating.
I loved the Ultimates. Like, hardcore loved that, and I've been afraid of going back and revisiting it for about 10 years, just knowing that was how Mark Miller looked at America during like the post 9/11 pro-war George W. Bush era, like through that lens, and that was how he was writing Captain America and the Avengers, and that I was like, I don't know if this is going to age very well. I'm really afraid to go back and look at those issues. But there were some, I still remember there were some amazing beats in those, like moments and scenes that Miller wrote and that Brian Hitch drew that still resonate with me.
He elevated the Avengers to a godlike level in a way that I don't think anybody had in a really long time. Both of them did, Miller and Hitch. And, right. And that was, you know, so much of what made the MCU possible, I think. So, so it's worth it for that. But you're right. They're a tough read these days.
All right, folks, that is going to wrap up our discussion of Avengers 312 and 313. This episode, as I mentioned, is a proud part of the Merry Marvel Marching Society 2021 Acts of Vengeance crossover. If you want to hear more episodes dedicated to this story, check out current or upcoming episodes of the following podcasts: Third Degree Burn, Back to the Bins, Coffee and Comics, Comic Book Time Machine, Doom Speak, The Fan Holes Podcast, Head Speaks, Into the Weird, Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power of Power Pack, Justice Not Entirely Dissimilar to Lightning, a Thunderbolts podcast, The Long Box Crusade, Make Ours Marvel, Married with Comics, The Quantum Cast, which my buddy Gene Hendricks, he loves him some Quasar. He's actually covering Avengers 311, the one before the issues that we just covered, because it's got Quasar in it. Also, Resurrections and Adam Warlock podcast, The Rolled Spine podcasts, and Views from the Long Box. Oh, also, another episode of FW Presents This Sunday, hosted by Shag, will tackle another issue from this event. Before we go, Jake, I want to thank you again for agreeing to do this. This was a great conversation. I didn't even know how much we were in sync when we were going to start talking about this stuff. Tons of fun. If people want to follow you on Twitter or social media, where can they do that?
They would follow me on Twitter at Drake Eichmann, capital D, capital I. And on Instagram, I don't Instagram, but you should follow my dog because she's adorable and she is my wife and I's life right now. She is at good.girl.apple.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into this episode of FW Presents. If you enjoyed our discussion, please support the show on social media by liking or favoriting the posts on Facebook and Twitter. You can leave a comment on the episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com, and you can always go to Apple Podcasts and leave a nice 5-star review for FW Presents or any other show on the Fire and Water Network. If you really like us, like you're crushing super hard, consider sponsoring the Fire and Water Network on Patreon. For more information, head on over to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. As always, thanks for listening.